debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
On the line with us is Lala Wu, the co-founder and executive director of the Sister District Project. That website, sisterdistrict.com, bringing women into politics. Sister_district is the Twitter handle, as well as _Lala, L-A-L-A, _Wu, W-U, _. Lala, welcome to the program. So glad to have you with us. Can you give us the details of the proposed Texas legislation and why it's consequential?
Thanks, Tom. So glad to be here. Texas already has some of the toughest voting laws in the country, and Republicans are trying to make them even tougher. And I think it's important to put this in a national context, that there have already been 17 states that have passed 28 laws restricting voting. And all of these are pushed by Republicans that are premised on the big lie that, of course, somehow Biden didn't win the election. And with the Texas law in particular, it truly is, a real parade of horribles. And I think what's important to note here is that it's not random. It's not just Republicans throwing spaghetti at the wall of what do they think might restrict voters, and in particular, voters of color. The background here is that in 2020, Harris County, which is where Houston is, they rolled out a bunch of new measures during the pandemic to help people vote. This includes drive-through voting, which 1 in 10 early voters took advantage of, expanded voting hours. They automatically sent ballots to eligible voters. They had 24-hour voting in the form of drop boxes. And what happened was that even though Republicans brought some litigation to challenge it, voters of color prevailed, and they really benefited from these expanded measures, and there was the highest turnout in 30 years. And now fast forward to where we are now, and of course, the Texas law wants to restrict all of these things. They want to ban drive-through voting. They want to get rid of those expanded voting hours. They want to eliminate 24-hour drop boxes. And they want to ban, mailing ballots to eligible voters, even criminalizing certain aspects of that process. And on top of that, they also want to add more protections for partisan poll workers, which really allow them to roam free and intimidate folks. We know that groups like the Proud Boys and other Trump-aligned Trump supporters have been recruited in the past to come to Harris County and to basically stand and, act as so-called poll watchers and create havoc in that way. They also want to criminalize things like small clerical errors And that's not the direction that we need to go in this country when it comes to how to vote. So the list goes on and on. There's new ID requirements for voting by mail, new requirements for people who are trying to help other people to vote. And the list, like I said, goes on and on and on. But this is really a very, very targeted attempt by the Texas Republicans to restrict all of the ways that Harris County in particular, which has a large urban black and brown population, were able to successfully expand the electorate.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court has essentially said, if the law doesn't say you can't vote if you're a person of color, if it doesn't say those words, basically it doesn't matter. That partisan gerrymandering, partisan restrictions on voting are just fine. And yet the partisan lines, you know, since 1968, when the Republican Party embraced white supremacy with Nixon's Southern Strategy, partisan divide has become also a racial divide in the United States.
Exactly.
And it just blows my mind that it doesn't actually, given who John Roberts is and the work that he did. I mean, you know, one of his major projects when he worked in the Reagan White House in Reagan's Department of Justice, trying to find ways around the Brown versus Board of Education law. He wrote a whole long paper on
That's right.
You know, suggesting ways to get around Brown v. Board, as well as Roe v. Wade, which I lay out in my book on the Supreme Court. Just look at the history of these people. It's just amazing. We're talking with Lala Wu, the co-founder and executive director of the Sister District Project. Sisterdistrict.com is the website. What are you hearing from, you know, your collaborators and colleagues in Texas about how people are pushing back on this? And if the Republicans succeed in getting this law passed, which actually looks like it's probable, I mean, at a certain point, these Democrats are going to have to go home. What will the fallout be? I mean, I've seen some optimists, for example, saying, you know, these laws against voting in Georgia, well, as you said, 17 states now, they're going to cause more Democrats to show up and people are going to be super energized, you know, sort of like the way Donald Trump. A lot of people showed up in the 2020 election, not so much to vote for Joe Biden, but to vote against Donald Trump. Is that optimism justified, or will these voter suppression efforts be sufficiently successful to crush voter turnout in the next election in 2022?
I think that if this law passes, it is going to be a huge blow to Democrats in Texas, but that doesn't mean that all hope is lost. There are really strong community-based organizations in Texas, Texas Organizing Project as an example of one of them, that really focus on building a strong electorate, a strong voter base, and turning people out despite all odds. Like I mentioned, Texas already has some of the strictest voting laws in the country. And, you know, no matter what happens, folks on the ground will be fighting tooth and nail, doing everything they can within the new laws to turn people out. So, yeah. You know, I would say nothing is for certain. We can't, take our eye off the ball. We have to continue to stay focused, continue to support the organizers and the Democrats in the state who are doing this hard work of fighting back. And, you know, what we are hearing on the ground, for example, Sister District, we build progressive power in state legislators and support state legislative swing district races. And last year, our alumni Representative Ann Johnson was the only red to blue flip in Texas, and she represents parts of Harris County, which is, as I mentioned, where Houston is located. She has become one of the leading voices in the walkout, and, you know, along with over 50 Democrats, as you mentioned, who left the state to break quorum and stop this bill from being rammed through, they're risking arrest and electoral challenges, even stronger electoral challenges when they get back to the state, when they're up for reelection. I mean, one of them even missed her wedding. And so people are really putting themselves out on the line. And, you know, I appreciate this opportunity to have this conversation, to continue to shine light on this very, very, serious issue that we need to continue to support the folks.
I saw a report on TV last night, and I'm assuming that it's credible. It was on either CNN or MSNBC. That said that, for example, in Georgia, when they declared that there was going to be a special election, you know, that Reverend Warnock ran in, as I recall, Or in Arizona, you had this special election with Mark Kelly, that in Texas, when you declare a special election, you have either 4 or 6 months from the time that it's declared and people throw their hat into the ring until the time that the election happens. And so there's plenty of time there for people who might be excited by that special election or particularly invigorated by the possibility of a candidate they like to register to vote. So under this new law in Texas, what they're saying is that special elections have to happen within 28 days. And once you register to vote, you may not vote for the first time until the 29th day, which prevents people from, you know, from voting in special elections if that's the thing that they're trying to address. I mean, it's just crazy, the granularity of this.
And here's the thing, Tom. I mean, Republicans are just merciless, right? Yeah. They just are highly targeted and strategic, and they take no prisoners when it comes to passing legislation that, benefits themselves.
Just like the old South. It's amazing. Lala Wu, the co-founder and executive director of SisterDistrict.com is the website, SisterDistrict.com. Sister_district also over on Twitter. Lala, thanks a lot for dropping by today. Great talking with you.
For our book club today, we're reading from Thomas Frank's book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. This is chapter one, titled Servile Disobedience. Social scientists have tried for more than a century to understand how class works. Psychological experiments on the subject, however, are a relatively novel thing, so I was surprised to discover a few years ago that psychologists had published a series of papers on the behavioral aspects of social status, and that their findings were almost uniformly unflattering towards society's winners. In one 2009 study in Psychological Science found that in conversations with strangers, high-status people tend to do more doodling and fidgeting, and also to use fewer engagement cues, looking at the other person, laughing, nodding their heads. A 2010 paper published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology found that lower-class individuals, in quote, turned out to be better performers on measures of such pro-social virtues as generosity, charity, and helpfulness. A third study found that those of higher status were noticeably worse at assessing the emotions of others or figuring out what facial expressions mean. All of which is to say the rich are different from you and me. They are more rude and less generous. They don't understand, they don't get what others are thinking, and apparently they don't really care. Perhaps this is obvious to you. After all, people don't design toxic debt obligations by calling on what they learned in Sunday school. Still, the research aroused media interest. The Christian Science Monitor's 2010 account of one study ended with this quotation from Michael Krauss, then the University of California, San Francisco, who is one of the researchers, quote, being empathic is one of the first steps to helping other people. One of the first things we're really interested in is what can make wealthy people, affluent people, the people with the capacity to give, what can make them empathic? I think I see the urgency of Dr. Krauss's question. After all, we have spent the past several decades doing everything we could to transfer the wealth of the nation into the bank accounts of the affluent to send them victorious, happy, and glorious, long to reign over us. Oh, we've cut their taxes, gladly transferring much of the cost of keeping their property safe onto our own shoulders. We've furnished them with special megaphones so that their voices can be heard over the hubbub of the crowd. We've conferred upon them separate and better schools, their very own transportation system, and a full complement of private security guards. We've built an entire culture of courtiers and syncopants to make their every working hour an otherworldly delight. We let them construct a system of bonuses and executive compensation on the theory that it would be good for everyone if the people at the top got to take home much, much more than the rest of us. And when it turned out that the theory was wrong, that in the most famous cases, executives chased bonuses not to the shareholders' benefit, but at their expense, why, we promptly bailed them out. We allowed them to step into the Fed's discount window and fill their pockets. We generously transferred their reckless investments to our balance sheet, and we chastised them with little more than a polite request that they please not do it again. We've done everything we can to lift them up and exalt them as the new Leviathan. The least they can do in return, one feels, is to show a little empathy. Besides, look what we've done with the old Leviathan, the government. For decades, we've attacked it, redirected it, outsourced it, and filled it with incompetence and cronies. Yes, it still works well enough when we need to blow up some small country. But those branches of it designed to help our Americans of lower socioeconomic status, in quotes, as the scientists would put it, are now bare. We need the rich to be nice, stop doodling, and to pay attention and get generous. Now that the government has divested from the empathy business, we need the rich to discover brotherly love and fast. Come to think of it, wasn't that supposed to be the deal in the first place? The arrangement Andrew Carnegie brokered over a century ago when he made his big career move from Steel King to public library baron? The laissez-faire social contract would grant private business a free hand, but in exchange, those who piled up massive wealth were supposed to extend a magnanimous hand to the rest of us. As Carnegie wrote in his famous 1889 essay, The Gospel of Wealth, but the billionaires with the strongest sense of class solidarity have a very different plan for their disposable income. Activating their lobbyists in Washington, building grassroots movements to march on their behalf, and using their media properties to run experiments on human credulity. Rendezvous with Oblivion reports from a sinking society.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back. We're kind of crowdsourcing, brainstorming solutions to the problem of inequality in the United States, crime that comes as a result of that, the social breakdown that comes, the crime is a symptom of. People think of crime as a core thing in and of itself, like it just magically appears out of nothing, you know, like a weed in your lawn. Well, the weed appears in your lawn because a seed got there and because the soil can nurture it. Crime doesn't come out of nothing either. Crime comes out of inequality. Crime comes out of despair. Crime comes out of opportunity in some cases. But at the bottom line, crime comes out of a lack of social fabric. It comes out of the breakdown of society. And we are seeing that hugely in the United States right now. And other developed countries, not so much. Why? Well, it's because we're the most unequal society in the developed world. Period. Way beyond anybody else. So, what do we do about that? Picking up your thoughts, Rhonda in Charleston, West Virginia. Hey, Rhonda, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Yes, I think I got a kind of a unique perspective on this. I taught high school for 34 years. I've come from the state that has the highest poverty, most least educated state in the nation. Mm-hmm. And after seeing more and more children graduate from high school, less of our children are having to find a way to go to college. Even our trade schools have become competitive. When I grew up in the 70s, about anybody could go to a trade school. Now it's gotten to the point, at least here, where it's become competitive even to go to a trade school. These children are graduating, many of them, not all of them, but many of them, without a clear path as to how to start their life, and they're hopeless. They're full of despair because it's a time when they're going to start their life. And you come here to Southern West Virginia, and you're really going to see a lot of poverty and no way to get out. These people can't just move out. Our biggest employer is Walmart. I mean, so we're not giving people I don't think criminals want to be criminal. I don't think they start out that way. But there is a point where, you know, these kids or these young people are saying, I have to live. And so I think that we need to start looking at how are we giving our people a path in order to make a living and to make their way in life. So I don't know what your idea is on that, but
that's a really important point, Rhonda, and that is, you know, this goes back to my original. In my original rant in the first hour where I said I really think that there are four things that we need to say are just core structural pillars to a functioning, developed society. And that is that everybody has access to health care that isn't going to bankrupt them, that everybody has access to education that isn't going to bankrupt them, everyone has access to housing that isn't going to bankrupt them, and everyone has access to enough food. And not just, you know, food desert food, not just Cheetos, but, you know, the stuff that you can buy in a 7-Eleven. I mean, there are literally parts of America where for a 10-mile radius or a 20-mile radius, the only food available is at dollar stores or 7-Elevens. I'm talking about real food.
We have whole counties with no grocery stores at all.
Exactly.
I mean, whole counties.
And what does that lead to? Obesity and type 2 diabetes and heart disease and, I mean, you know, process and cancer. Processed food jacks up your risk of cancer. It leads to all these terrible outcomes. So if we could just establish the floor, those four items as a basic floor, those, by the way, were the key components of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program that has been just whittled away at ever since, the Reagan presidency. But if we just could do those four things and lift people up a little bit to reestablish a middle class in America and reestablish social trust among people and then diminish this massive wealth at the top where we're not seeing, you know, I mean, what was it, a couple of years ago, it was Larry Ellison and some other billionaire were competing to see who could have the biggest yacht. You know, is it 435 feet or 485 feet? And now it's, you know, who can have the biggest rocket ship to blast themselves into outer space? People are watching this and going, what the hell? I can't feed my family and I'm supposed to be cheering this guy, you know, who paid 1% in income taxes last year, blasting off into outer space. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Randy in Atlanta. Randy, your thoughts.
It's like any other problem. We have to admit it, that we have a serious issue and racism is at the top of the heap. When racism is sold as a product, in which that's what it's been sold in this country, and you have too many people has bought into it, meaning you have a lot of white people that still believe that if I buy into this theory that I'm better than anyone else and that I'm supposed to have, then people are not going to do what they are, back to that saying as kids, they're not going to do what they're supposed to do.
Right.
So when I look at people like Trump and the people of his ilk, I mean, it's disturbing, Tom. People like Trump have to be just taken out of the mix because they're selling lies and they're destroying everything good about human race.
I'm assuming, Rudy, you do not mean that in any way that implies violence.
No, it's not about violence, Tom. It's about doing what's socially.
Yeah.
It's about doing what is right socially. And this tears down everyone, especially the ones that believe in it. Because if these people keep believing that, oh, I got all the marbles and no one's going to eat, you keep on eating a steak out in the middle of nowhere and watch what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well said, Rudy. Thank you very much. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Oh, Professor, I'm getting an A in this class. The question on the floor is, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
No problem. Start with services. What's another way of saying homelessness? No services. Look here. My mother had some problems. We call her mommy had some problems, but they had services back then. The patriarch in my family was an alcoholic, a veteran, but we had a place to take, Papa Bear, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but we ain't got them services today. Now, I think what we need to do, we need to make America great again. That's right. I said it. Go back to 1959, the corporate tax rate was 92%. Now, what did that do? That kept money in circulation. They couldn't hoard money. Now, what's your best investment? You got to go to education. I remember when the United States led the world in education.
Yep.
Now our students are in loan debt. I remember when California was number second in the United States. Now we're 48. The teacher I heard to say 40. She's number 48. Number 49. The worst. Gee whiz, my Lord. We all down there. Now, what's going on here? We got to think opposition politics. We didn't have that when you was a young man. We get it big time now. And they're surrogates of the devil. Why? Because they're authors of confusion, all right? And they operate on a double standard, and their food of choice. That's their food of choice, confusion, double standards. They got mouthpieces. They got lobbyists. They got judges. They got public officials. Let me tell you what else they got organizations. They got your Koch brothers, your Federalist Foundation, your Heritage Society. These people are not for democracy. Now, I'm going to tell you how we can beat them. I'm going to tell you how we can beat them. Ain't but one way out. More people got to vote. The big blue wave of defeat anything, and that includes gerrymandering. Call me crazy. Talk to you later.
No, Morris, you need your own YouTube channel or TikTok or whatever it may be, because Morris, you got the greatest rants. Morris just hung up. He just, you know, delivers his rants and amazing. I love Morris's rants. Joan in San Francisco. Hey, Joan, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
In San Francisco, there's a plan to reduce the number of toilets for the homeless.
Why?
I just found out about it yesterday. It doesn't say why. It says that this month the city's plan to substantially reduce access to public toilets across San Francisco, targeting locations with high concentrations of unhoused San Franciscans, was unveiled.
Is this to discourage people from pitching their tents near the public toilets?
Absolutely, and yeah. It's not just that. They have a no sit and lie law in San Francisco that was put in by something like a business improvement district, not necessarily the local people. And they have removed every place that people can sit down. The benches, they actually hacked off a concrete bench off a wall at the Buena Vista Park because young people sat there. And they removed all the laws.
See, this is dealing with the symptoms of a problem rather than the causes.
Well, it's worse than that. It's hostile architecture. There's a hatefulness about it. You know, you can't sit down. You can't get water to give your dog. You know, there's no place to go to the bathroom. I mean, I went to the public restroom last week and at 7:30. That's supposed to close at 8, and it was already closed. It's very awful, and they put rocks under the trees so people can't sit there in this new section that they just opened up on near Stanion Street, Stanion and Haight, and they've got these big carpets of rocks.
Wow! I know the area. I used to, in the summer of '68, I lived on Fell Street right off Haight. Just a couple blocks in the corner of Haight and Ashbury. Thank you. Thanks for the report and the information. This is terrible. Thank you, Joan. We need to do something.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We need to do something deep and systemic. We need to look at the causes of this problem, not just the symptoms.
For our book club today, we're reading from Thomas Frank's book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. This is chapter one, titled Servile Disobedience. Social scientists have tried for more than a century to understand how class works. Psychological experiments on the subject, however, are a relatively novel thing. So I was surprised to discover a few years ago the psychologist had published a series of papers on the behavioral aspects of social status, and that their findings were almost uniformly unflattering towards society's winners. In one 2009 study in Psychological Science found that in conversations with strangers, high-status people tend to do more doodling and fidgeting and also to use fewer engagement cues, looking at the other person, laughing, nodding their heads. A 2010 paper published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology found that lower-class individuals, in quote, turned out to be better performers on measures of such pro-social virtues as generosity, charity, and helpfulness. A third study found that those of higher status were noticeably worse at assessing the emotions of others or figuring out what facial expressions mean. All of which is to say the rich are different from you and me. They are more rude and less generous. They don't understand, they don't get what others are thinking, and apparently they don't really care. Perhaps this is obvious to you. After all, people don't design toxic debt obligations by calling on what they learned in Sunday school. Still, the research aroused media interest. The Christian Science Monitor's 2010 account of one study ended with this quotation from Michael Krauss, then the University of California, San Francisco, who is one of the researchers, quote, "Being empathic is one of the first steps to helping other people. one of the first things we're really interested in is what can make wealthy people, affluent people, the people with the capacity to give, what can make them empathic? I think I see the urgency of Dr. Krause's question. After all, we have spent the past several decades doing everything we could to transfer the wealth of the nation into the bank accounts of the affluent to send them victorious, happy, and glorious long to reign over us. Oh, we've cut their taxes, gladly transferring much of the cost of keeping their property safe onto our own shoulders. We've furnished them with special megaphones so that their voices could be heard over the hubbub of the crowd. We've conferred upon them separate and better schools, their very own transportation system, and a full complement of private security guards. We've built an entire culture of courtiers and syncopants to make their every working hour an otherworldly delight. We let them construct a system of bonuses and executive compensation on the theory that it would be good for everyone if the people at the top got to take home much, much more than the rest of us. And when it turned out that the theory was wrong, that in the most famous cases, executives chased bonuses not to the shareholders' benefit, but at their expense, why, we promptly bailed them out. We allowed them to step into the Fed's discount window and fill their pockets. We generously transferred their reckless investments to our balance sheet. And we chastised them with little more than a polite request that they please not do it again. We've done everything we can to lift them up and exalt them as the new Leviathan. The least they can do in return, one feels, is to show a little empathy. Besides, look what we've done with the old Leviathan, the government. For decades, we've attacked it, redirected it, outsourced it, and filled it with incompetence and cronies. Yes, it still works well enough when we need to blow up some small country. But those branches of it designed to help our Americans of lower socioeconomic status, in quotes, as the scientists would put it, are now bare. We need the rich to be nice, stop doodling, and to pay attention and get generous. Now that the government has divested from the empathy business, we need the rich to discover brotherly love and fast. Come to think of it, wasn't that supposed to be the deal in the first place? The arrangement Andrew Carnegie brokered over a century ago when he made his big career move from Steel King to Public Library Baron? The laissez-faire social contract would grant private business a free hand, but in exchange, those who piled up massive wealth were supposed to extend a magnanimous hand to the rest of us. As Carnegie wrote in his famous 1889 essay, The Gospel of Wealth, we don't need socialism to solve our problems. Philanthropy is the true antidote for the temporary inequality distribution of wealth and reconciliation of the rich and poor, quoting Carnegie. Going further, Carnegie argued that the duty of the man of wealth was, quote, to consider all surplus revenues which come to him simply as trust funds, which he's called upon to administer in the manner which, in his judgment, is best calculated to produce the most beneficial results for the community, the man of wealth thus becoming the mere trustee and agent for his poorer brethren, end quote. That same way of thinking led Carnegie to support the estate tax. Of all forms of taxation, this seems the wisest, he wrote. It was wise because it would, quote, induce the rich man to attend to the administration of wealth during his life. And if he didn't, then the tax would return most of his hoardings to the community from which it came, using Carnegie's words. Vestiges of the Carnegie attitude survive to this day. 2009 study of high net worth individuals by Barclays Wealth confirmed that American philanthropists tend to understand their giving in a context in which the state is either absent or irrelevant. And, of course, there are plenty of nice plutocrats who don't fidget or doodle when talking to strangers and who have no problem endowing a ward or a wing in return for a commemorative plaque. The business headlines even occasionally tell of billionaires coming together under the leadership of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates to donate their fortunes to worthy causes. But the billionaires with the strongest sense of class solidarity have a very different plan for their disposable income. Activating their lobbyists in Washington, building grassroots movements to march on their behalf, and using their media properties to run experiments on human credulity. Rendezvous with Oblivion reports from a sinking society.
Eric in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind?
A lot of real kind of pinpoint ideas to deal with all of it. I mean, you really put it out there. I mean, you know, crime and homelessness and inequality and racism and yada, yada. But if there is one single policy change that we could make in America, it would be to look to the nation that trained Christopher Columbus on how to find America, and that was Portugal. And we need to end our war on drugs. Its tentacles reach out and touch everything.
Yeah, we've done that here in Oregon. You know, we decriminalized all possession of small amounts of all drugs.
And we'll get a decade of that, and we'll see how crime rates have plummeted there, because they're sure to, just as they have in Portugal. And if you you think about the way whole families are affected generationally, and it's not, you know, if you take drug war as a term of a policy, you have problems that come from the drugs, for sure. Largely manageable and largely individualized if you look at drug problems. But if you look at the war problems, those are systemic and societal. And you hit on something earlier when, you know, you're trying to find a term for it. Kenyatta had said something about, well, what do we want equality to look like? Or do we want these people to achieve the sameness of wealthy white people? And later on, you responded to somebody about having agency. And I think an extension of that is having dignity. Mm. And the individual identifies that for themselves. And there's a lot more people who are not really motivated by money than most people would think, but they find their dignity elsewhere. I mean, we revere people who, you know, take up the cloth and vow poverty and things like that. We see that as so noble, and yet in our competitive, consumerist, capitalistic paradigm, and I think you would see business fertilizer in little micro mini businesses all over the country.
What you're talking about, Eric, is what is in Scandinavia and most of Europe. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's just this.
I'm headed there.
Yeah, this is
I've been telling you for years. I'm waiting out this lawsuit, and I'm moving to Europe as soon as it's over.
I get it. Yeah. And your thing on the war on drugs is so spot on. When I was a little kid, I mean, you know, like 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, I had three best friends. Three. There was four boys, four of us who used to hang out together. Mm-hmm. And one of us, when he turned 17, I think it was,
The guy went to prison, your buddy.
He got busted with some pot, and they sent him to prison for 2 years. And he came back shattered. I mean, shattered.
I'm a felon because I forged my own prescriptions 20-some years ago before the whole opioid epidemic was a familiar term.
Yeah.
I was one of the first casualties.
So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
And
I know what you're talking about. Eric, thank you. Thank you. Spot on and very well said. So we're talking about what do we do about crime in America, and to what extent is crime actually a symptom of larger societal problems, the largest being massive inequality. But there's all kinds of other structural things. We have, since the Reagan Revolution, eroded public housing, low-income housing. We have eroded the ability of people to get health care without going bankrupt. We have pretty much done away with the ability to go to college, any kind of meaningful college, without ending up in such debt that you can't start a family or buy a house. And increasingly across America, we're seeing food deserts where people actually don't even have access to nutritional food. It is nuts, and we need to do something about it. Bobby in La Puente, California. Hey, Bobby, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I want to weigh in on this, on the poverty, you know, despair, like the teacher from West Virginia. She was describing me back in the, we're the same age, Tom, and mm-hmm. I compare myself to you. At 17, you're a DJ, you know, doing good. On the other side of the coin, I was starting my addiction on alcohol.
Mm.
For what? Because inequality, right? The name calling. You know, there's a racist component to it. I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley. And there's a book I want to suggest to you, Tom, if you want to read it. It's called Always Running, Luis J. Rodriguez. He grew up in a couple miles down from where I did, you know, the gang situation. But he got out of it, wrote a book, describes how I grew up. The law enforcement, they look at you, no respect, you just a brown skin, you know, throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have that mindset, you don't have no respect for society.
Right.
You know, I thought of, what do I do if my family was in need? A drug deal, and I don't like to think of that. And you know what? Jobs, union jobs, okay? Do the opposite of what Reagan did. Bring back health care for those that need it. I sure needed it. But you know what? Alcohol served a purpose. Alcohol and drugs are just a symptom of what's going on.
Yep.
It doesn't. It affects the whites, every color, right?
Right. And but it affects historically discriminated against communities worse than it does white communities, right across the board.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and in our community, hey, if you went to Corcoran, wow. It, you know, honest, where you should have graduated, where did you do time? They asked me. Mm-hmm. I never did time. I was lucky. Yeah. You know, a little county, glass house, you know, but never, you know, that was the pride in that community because that's all we were good for. We were hard workers. We had to break out of that. In the community, they need, say, counseling, right? Where I grew up, counseling, right? Therapy, mental health in schools.
Yes.
Because I got a daughter, 38, with my granddaughter, will be 8 years old in a couple of weeks, homeless, but they live with us.
Yeah.
Well, it's okay. You know what? I can give back.
Yeah.
I'll help anybody. My neighbor, I'm growing, you know, garden. You need something? Here.
Yeah.
And that's all, bringing compassion, empathy, and understanding. And how about using the golf courses for the homeless? I heard that from George Carlin years ago.
Oh, yeah.
A little white ball. Yeah. Right? They already got facilities there. Yeah,
I like that.
Think about it.
I like that.
The greedy people. I used to hit a golf ball with a baseball bat, see how far I can get it.
Yeah.
You know, I was just surviving, Tom, and I'm lucky I'm here. I lost my, you had three brothers. Mine are gone.
Yeah.
And I'm the eldest.
Oh, my.
A lot of it, addiction. Well, I was raised by a World War II dad.
Yeah.
That tells you something.
Same here. Yeah.
And I hope nobody goes through that. You know what I mean? So, but bless you, Tom, what you do, and the rest of the crew, your wife, I have to include them all. I get a little manic. Your union. Thank you.
Thank you, Bobby. You always bring it back to compassion and caring for each other as fellow human beings, and it's so important. Thank you so much. Nancy in Chihuahua, Washington. Hey, Nancy. Hey, we have about a minute and a half
before we have
to wrap up. I'm fine. What's up?
Clubhouse programs. They're huge. Fountain House is the biggest one in New York City.
What is a clubhouse program?
Housing. Huh?
I'm sorry. You were going to start telling me. I was saying, what is a clubhouse program?
Clubhouse program is where they ease people with a history of mental illness back into working.
Mm-hmm.
And also they have a homeless program where they sign the leases on apartments, and then they guarantee the rent, and then they put mentally ill people in the apartments, and they all share the rent and pay it to Fountain House, you know, not for profit or anything, just... And they've expanded so much. They own buildings, apartment buildings now, and co-ops and all kinds of things. And that they've been doing great. But in a lot of the red states, the psychiatry industry tries to undermine them and shut them down because, one, they could treat hundreds of or thousands of clients with just one PhD psychiatrist that heads the program. And they get the chronics off the street, and that a lot of these outpatient clinics depend on the chronics.
That's remarkable.
But the thing is, Fountain House, they don't do counseling or meds, and they encourage their clients to do it outpatient.
Yeah. Nancy, I've written it down.
Poetry doesn't like them.
I've written it down. I will do a deep dive after we get off the air. Thank you so much. I'm learning so much from all of you. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Aaron in Tacoma. Hey, Aaron, what's on your mind today?
I just wanted to talk about inequality and how that affects society. And I heard a caller talking about the corporate greed of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And the corporate greed of healthcare is ultimately affecting our society, as you see in Portland with the mental health crises, the tents, the homelessness, and the breakdown in that matter. Mm-hmm. That is America and society being greedy, not supplying healthcare to all. That only doesn't affect mental health, but that affects every aspect of the body, especially considering the fact that we all pay out the wazoo for health insurance, and that does not cover dental, vision, hearing. Is that not part of our human body? Should we have to pay separately for another insurance on our body?
You are singing my song, Aaron. I just yesterday, I just got a copy of my next book. I got to have a physical copy in my hand here, The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. It won't be available for sale for another month or so. But I just got a copy, everything you just said is in that. The research that I did for that book just completely blew my mind about how bad things are in the United States, how they got this way, what a huge role race played in getting them this way, among other things. Go ahead.
It's unbelievable, Tom, and it's the lobby. It's the lobbyists that control our government, that control the healthcare industry. And that includes the dental lobby, the vision lobby, et cetera. I've been a healthcare worker for 14 years, and I love working with patients. I love community. But the healthcare industry is broken. It is only there for the people at the top, and all they're looking out for is their profits and not caring about patients. If people remember, when a doctor becomes a physician, you have to take a Hippocratic oath. And that is to look out for the patients and not yourself. It's always to be the patients. We don't look at healthcare like that in today's age. All we look at is a patient is a number and a monetary figure, and that is wrong.
Yeah, yeah, I'm completely with you.
And absolutely wrong. And the healthcare industry is only going to get worse because people aren't going to want to work in it because of that reason. Of that greed is going to scare people away that actually have compassion and passion for humans.
Well, this is the thing. Starting in the 1980s, prior to the 1980s, to the best of my knowledge, every state in the union, there may be an outlier here that I didn't find, but as far as I could tell, every state in the union required health insurance companies to be nonprofits and hospitals to be nonprofits. And I was, I grew up in Michigan, and in the early 70s, we had an herbal tea company, and we had a little factory. We had 18 people working for us, me and my partner, mm-hmm. Terry O'Connor. And we provided health care to everybody. It was Blue Cross Blue Shield. It cost $30 per month per employee. I remember it quite well, And
they probably had no deductible at that time.
No, there was nothing. And you could see any doctor anytime, and you could go anywhere in the hospitals. And now the three hospitals in Lansing, St. Lawrence, Sparrow, and Ingham Medical are now, and Ingham Medical is no longer owned by Ingham County. It's now a private corporation. They changed the name. Sparrow and St. Lawrence have both become for-profit. The health insurance companies have all become for-profit. The prices are through the roof. And I guarantee you the $30 per month per person that I used to pay for health insurance doesn't even cover deductibles today. I mean,
That wouldn't even cover a doctor's visit, Tom. It is a crying shame that we live in this kind of society.
I am with you. Aaron, thank you for the call. Thank you. That was brilliant. What do we do about all of these problems? This is a multidimensional, multifactorial issue that, in my opinion, we find the roots of in the neoliberal turn that America took in 1980 when we embraced Reaganism and Reaganomics. And we are still in the Reaganism-Reaganomics era. We have not yet repudiated it. We have not yet raised the top tax rate on the very, very richest above 50% like it was before Reagan came into office. We have not raised the corporate tax rate up into the 30s and 40% for those corporations that are essentially printing money like we did before Reagan came into office. We have not made it easier for people to form labor unions across the United States. In fact, if anything, we've made it much, much harder, and we've destroyed unionization. We have not strengthened the social safety net, which Lyndon Johnson did in the era from 1965 through 1968 with Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Well, Social Security, he expanded children's health insurance programs, food stamps, Section 8 housing, low-income housing, construction of new housing. I mean, there was a whole spectrum of programs that were part of what was called the Great Society. Some people refer to it as the Second Reconstruction. There was this whole series of programs that were designed to help out people who were the victims, essentially, of, well, it wasn't called Reaganism at that point yet, but of the Republican efforts back in the 1920s. And the whittling away of the New Deal. You know, the Franklin Roosevelt did an awful lot of great stuff in the 1930s and the early 1940s. And then, you know, we just started whittling away at it. And LBJ put it, not just put it back together, but built it even larger. And over the last 40 years, what have we seen? The gradual but consistent and steady destruction of all of it. David in Monterey, California. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Communities need to make fair rules for the citizens to live together. And fair rules, and that would help make sure that the homeless keep their areas clean, that they can live. And somebody talked about community centers, and I think they should have adult community centers where they teach people to do penny capitalism, like beading work and any kind of other type of thing that they can make money on their own. Maybe a day labor place and a path to school for those that can go to school. And that way we can live together as a community instead of fighting against that community and raise people up out of that homeless situation.
Yeah.
And take a sense of pride in our homeless situation instead of treating them like they're the enemy.
Like
Seattle. We rode up to Seattle, and they had put the homeless in these little camps, and then they left them alone so that the bullies would run the camps, and they allowed the trash to build up so that they can go in and say, oh, this ain't working, and we'll just take everything out. We actually need fair rules that are spelled out and community outreach. The police could be used as an outreach to the homeless, not somebody to come and hit them with a club or chase them from one place to another. And yet, last point is, if you have enough sleep, you can deal with anything. If you don't get enough sleep, you cannot deal with nothing.
Yeah.
And I got...
Okay.
That's my rant.
It's a good rant, David. and I completely get it. And I think that, you know, a big piece of this is simply providing housing to homeless people. You know, New York City did some of this during the pandemic, where they actually were using some of the hotels that were vacant as housing for homeless people. And now they're making some of that permanent, actually. And, you know, we need services. This is, you know, somebody earlier said, I think it was Morris, said services, you know, the key to it. Provide people with health care, provide them with education, provide them with addiction treatment, provide them with mental health treatment, provide them, most importantly, with a place to live and food to eat. This is such a large topic. I think that Sharon Lee wrote a piece for shelterforce.org about what Seattle is up to and what they're doing, how they're building tiny houses for homeless people. And as of this moment, they are housing, you know, close to 1,000 people in these. 879, that was just during 2018. The villages served 879 homeless men, women, and children. Of the 491 who exited the villages, a total of 166, or 34%, were successful in obtaining permanent housing. If you include the people who moved into transitional housing, that takes it up to 42%. This is great stuff. I mean, Seattle is doing, apparently has a great start on this, and I want to get more detail on that as time goes on. Loretta, speaking of Seattle, in Seattle. Hey, Loretta, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to your comment about the food deserts. Mm-hmm. and the contribution to the different diseases and illnesses.
Malnutrition, yeah.
And the reality that we're dealing with is the fact that the unhealthy benefit the wealthy, and as long as we have the healthcare system that we have, there's no incentive for the people benefiting off of the unhealthy to change that.
Yeah, my old friend Don Hoy, who ran the Creative Health Institute before he died, long story, but anyhow, he used to say every cancer diagnosis is a $250,000 for the healthcare industry.
Mm-hmm.
So why would they be working to stop cancer? I mean, which is a totally cynical statement, but it's also in the perhaps at the human view, it's not 100% right, but in the macro, in economics, they refer to it as perverse incentives. We have a system that incentivizes sickness rather than incentivizes wellness, and one of the reasons why countries in Europe and in South Asia, in Asia, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, one of the reasons why they have large public health programs to discourage smoking, encourage good eating, encourage good access to a wide variety of fresh foods, encourage exercise, is because it reduces their healthcare costs, which for them is good. Whereas if you try to do that, with the old hospital chain that Senator Rick Scott used to own, or the other hospital chain that's former Senator Bill Frist used to own, it hurts their bottom line if you make people healthier. So I think you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it. Thank you very much for the call. Lauren in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Lauren, what's up?
Well, about the homeless problem, it's really just, it's horrible here. And I can't even go to the grocery store these days without somebody approaching me in the parking lot asking for help because they don't have money to pay for the electricity or for food.
Yeah.
So, we've got some programs that are aimed at trying to help, using empty hotels and things like that, but it's just a drop in the bucket. The other day, I was driving around in Scottsdale, and I saw a sign that was up by the freeway, and it was encouraging people not to give anything to panhandlers.
An official sign?
An official sign from the city of Scottsdale.
Yeah. It's the idea that by giving money to panhandlers, you're encouraging them to continue panhandling. But again, they're dealing with a symptom rather than the problem. What is it that creates panhandlers? Deep poverty. What creates deep poverty? It's a tearing of the social fabric. We just have to recognize this. We are looking at the fabric of this country over a 40-year period of Reaganism being just literally ripped apart. Well, not literally, but metaphorically ripped apart. And we have to address this. We have to address this in a multidisciplinary way, and we have to do a good job of doing it, frankly, and we're not doing any of that. Loretta?
Yeah, people who are homeless, they're the victims of crimes more often than not. Talk about crime and homelessness. There was a woman, I was in the emergency room not too long ago, the woman next to me, she was crying her eyes out because she didn't have a home to return to. Someone had attempted to rape her right before she got to the hospital, and they just threw her out.
Wow. This should not be in the United States. The richest nation in the world. We should not have these kinds of stories being told. Lauren, thank you. Thank you for your contribution to the conversation. It was brilliant. Bill in Sun City, Arizona. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Tom, the problem isn't that we ignore the problems. The problem is that we ignore the simple solutions. All the problems we don't ignore. We can name them. They have names. We've identified them. Hunger. There's an invasive species swimming up our American rivers. What gets thrown away today could feed the masses. We ignore the solutions. The hungry people at the border could help us gather up that invasive species and create an economy that can go to both sides of the border and help a lot of people.
Yeah.
Poverty. Well, wait a second, please. I'm sorry.
Sure.
But poverty. Poverty, the solution to poverty is money. Where do we get money? We know where to get money. We've done it before. You've mentioned it. It's called a STET tax. 0.1%. 1/10 of 1% of $1 billion, Tom, is $1 million. The stock market creates $50 billion a day. That's $50 million. That if you're trading it at percentages of less than 0.1% to 1%, a dime on $100, you're in the wrong business.
Yeah.
But so, the answers are there, Tom.
Yeah.
As far as housing, we can build housing that now marijuana is going to be legal. We got to grow hemp like it's going out of style. An 18-inch stick hemp block has an R value of 41. You can live in an R41 home in the desert and never need air conditioning, or very likely need air conditioning. You could live in the stark winters and hardly need heat. I mean, yeah. The answer, they're there. There are simple, simple solutions to them, and we have to just stop ignoring them.
I'm with you. I'm with you. Bill, thank you. Jamie in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Jamie, your thoughts.
Hi. So I think that the three main things that people need access to in order to be able to stay off of the streets, first of all, is food, because we know that without food, there's a sense of hopelessness and despair that comes, and it's going to make them, force them into situations of crime, which is just going to spiral out of control. Second is education, and I'm talking about from kindergarten all the way on to college. They need access to equal education and well-funded education so that they do have options when they grow up, when these kids grow up and they have options for their family other than stealing. And finally, we need a healthcare system, specifically mental health, that everyone can access, and one that does not treat mental illness as an acute problem. Because currently in the United States, mental illness is treated as an acute problem. You might get hospitalized for a week if you're willing or if the circumstances are bad enough, and then they just throw you back out there, hopefully with a prescription that you may or may not be able to afford, and it's really not solving anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I believe the solution to all of this is to get money out of politics and corporations out of politics, because not only are they stealing all that money from the people that need it, but they're also spreading all this rhetoric that you need to work for what you get, and desensitizing people to thinking that it's okay to let people starve to death or suffer because they're not working.
Yeah, I am with you, Jamie, and that was one of the more comprehensive analyses that I've heard, and you did a great job. Thank you so much for that, and thanks for listening to us on SiriusXM there in Salt Lake City. And I would say, to point to where this all began, one of the things that Jamie was talking about was education. People need good quality education from kindergarten through college. And we had that in the United States prior to 1980. Just ask any old fart like me, you know, who came up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and they will tell you. You know, you could go to any college you had to have a certain skill level to get in, obviously, or trade schools were widely available, unions trained people. And then what did Reagan do? He put Bill Bennett in charge of the education department. And we began deconstructing education across the United States. And who was Bill Bennett? Bill Bennett is the guy who said this.
But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down. That would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do. But your crime rate would go down.
That was the Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan. This is where it began. And this is what it has brought us to. And yeah, there's a racial component to it, obviously, as well as a class component, as well as a greed component, as well as a, you know, it's tearing our society apart, and we have to do something about that.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.